You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. There has been so much talk, and nothing new, but with the upcoming 2024 elections, we're starting to see political parties digging in. We're starting to see people voicing opinions, strong opinions in some cases, others are more laid back and not willing, as they say, to show their hand at this point. But then the fact of the matter is that as we approach another election year and another presidential election year, there is certainly going to be a lot of controversy one way or the other. And that's why I invited my guest this week. Miles Taylor is the author of the new book, Blowback. Miles was also Secretary of Chief of Staff of the Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, and anonymously wrote a piece in the New York Times, and from that point, really rose to meteoric rights in putting forth ideas and things that he saw specifically. So for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Miles Taylor and getting his views on what it was really like within the Trump administration, but also we'll be talking with Miles about presidential elections in general, administrations, and so much that the average voter, the average taxpayer, the average citizen in this country does not know much about. Miles, nice to have you with us.
Al, it's great to be with you.
I know you've worked inside government, and that gave you a bird's eye view, as they say, of what was going on. But I get the sense after reading the book, and I just want to get your views on this, that what you anticipated and how you might have thought about politics or where you were at that point in time, starting out with your career, especially with the Trump administration, those years and your experience within the Department of Homeland Security really changed you not only politically but as a person. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it is. You know, I mean, I guess in a sense, I'm thinking about this as we're talking about it, Al. I feel like I sort of changed as Washington changed. You know, when I first came to D.C. after 9/11, despite all of the turmoil rocking the country, it really was a moment of unity. And as a young aide on Capitol Hill, I could see that. You know, members of Congress would meet in the back of the chamber, and they would laugh and backslap and argue with each other. But ultimately, they would cut deals to keep the country running and to protect the country. And it was sort of that spirit of bipartisanship that really pulled me into Washington. Now, you know, fast forward 15 years, the environment there changed quite considerably. And as the discourse got coarser, if you will, I think I started to become a little bit more cynical and you know, followed that trajectory. And I think that happened to a lot of people around the country, is as that feeling of unity burned off after 9/11, it was sort of jarring to get put back into the political sphere. But then Donald Trump's rise was something else entirely. It wasn't the normal political tumult we were used to in our politics. It was something a great deal more turbulent.
Growing up, I'm a product of the 50s, and you know, back then you had limited, really limited information. I mean, you had black and white TV. You had just a few major, you know, NBC, ABC news, and you know, newspapers. And yeah, there was talk on the streets. There was talk in your local grocery stores, your local coffee shops, so on and so forth. Today we have 24/7 news cycles. The age of the internet. And the web has enabled people to you know, to download information instantaneously, you know, moment after moment, second after second. What I'm getting at is there's a tremendous amount of information, a lot of it not even being quantified or qualified, that comes through. But I did want to go back to something, as you talked about, to this day. I mean, he's been out of office for 3.5 years, Donald Trump, and you know, wants to make a comeback. People are adamantly opposed. Some are adamantly opposed. Some are still for him. But let me ask you, I mean, many people that enter Washington politics many times come from, you know, state the state politics, the local politics. So in other words, it's in their blood. This guy came from the business world where he called his own shots. He was an entrepreneur from start. Does that make it any different? Does that give you reason to think that, well, you know, he wasn't going to play by the same rules because he's always played by his own rules?
Yeah, I mean, I think that at the outset, a lot of people, especially on the right, on the political right where I come from as a conservative, wanted to give Donald Trump a shot, and in fact were attracted by the fact that he was an outsider, that he was a businessman, and was disruptive. But no one could tell you they went into the Trump administration unsure of who this guy was. It was very clear that Donald Trump was of deeply insufficient moral character. But the hope, even among people like me, conservatives who opposed him within the party, we still wanted to see him grow into the job and still hoped that Trump would end up in the Oval Office and, like his predecessors, Barack Obama and George W. Bush, who talked about how the office changed them. There was this sense that maybe Trump would get in there and some of his more defective traits would be ameliorated by the responsibilities of the office, by just that sober moment of walking across the threshold into the Oval Office is something for which there's no comparison, and hopefully would take him and make him a more responsible commander-in-chief. That was, in hindsight, woefully naive, because that's not what happened with Donald Trump, and he didn't acclimate to the office and start to try to learn the rule of law and about our institutions and respect democracy's guardrails. If anything, he became more and more hostile towards those institutions and the rule of law and democracy's guardrails. And watching that in real time was pretty disturbing to me, especially, again, as someone who'd started off in Washington as sort of a hopeful optimist about what politics could be. You know, witnessing that was pretty difficult to see. I mean, it would be difficult to see from any public servant, but when it's the president of the United States disavowing those important understructures of our society, it's a five-alarm fire.
You had mentioned, and I think it's a known fact, that he was not a seasoned politician. He didn't come from a political background. He was an entrepreneur, a man used to running his own show. And I think of, you know, I look back, consider myself somewhat of a history buff. Harry Truman was a haberdasher, not necessarily a political person as well. But as you said, you either grow into the job or you grow in opposition. And this is what seems to have happened. I mean, if I were one of his handlers, or for lack of a better term, somebody on the inside, he just seems to this day has a tendency to just shoot from the hip without thinking or just gathering his team together. And I'm sure that was frustrating. But let me ask you, Miles, in general, people becoming president, anybody who gets elected to president of the United States, that's got to be an aphrodisiac. I mean, that gives them a sense of massive power, which it is. And many people, I believe, many past presidents and perhaps even future presidents would always have difficulty handling that. I'm not trying to make excuses for Donald Trump or anybody else, but I'm just saying, does anybody really grow into this job in a proper fashion? And should we cut them a little bit of slack and think, hey, what if you were, you're master of the domain and you had all this power? Would you be the same person as well? Is that a fair evaluation?
Well, I mean, there's the old adage, Al, that power tends to lead to corruption. The famous quote is, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. The president of the United States does not have absolute power. And I will say, from the get-go, Donald Trump expressed frustration with that reality, mm-hmm. which should have been a warning sign to everyone. In
right.
fact, the foreign partners that he most wanted to engage with and most idealized were the autocrats and not fellow democratic leaders. So it was Xi Jinping, the Chinese premier. It was Vladimir Putin in Russia. It was Kim Jong-un in North Korea. Those were the world leaders he looked up to because in them he saw the type of system he wanted to have,
right,
where he could have absolute power. And power tends to corrupt people in public office, partly because a lack of accountability. They feel like when they're in those positions, they're above the law. Often isolation, because, you know, people talk about a bubble in Washington. You really are removed from the broader public, and that leads you to start thinking and acting in different ways, but also groupthink, because you surround yourself with people who want to flatter you as the leader. And that becomes, those three things together, a noxious cocktail that then really fuels a final element, which is self-interest. It's really difficult for anyone in power, and this is throughout world history, to not bring their self-interest into the equation once they're in higher office. And that is the dilemma of a public servant, is to make sure that they are suppressing that impulse. And that's why we try to elect people of character. Unfortunately, in the case of Donald Trump, I saw this firsthand, he regularly was putting his self-interest before the country's interest. And that meant using the levers of government for retribution and to weaponize them for political purposes in a way that would benefit himself. That's not how government's supposed to operate. And anyone who has any illusion about whether that is how Donald Trump behaved merely needs to look at his current campaign, which is solely focused on getting back into office and getting revenge. And that those have been his words. He said that if reelected to the White House, he would exact retribution against his adversaries. That is a whole campaign focused on one individual's personal self-interest. And, you know, so with that in mind, I think Donald Trump perfectly fits the adage. And I think power really did corrupt him. And again, to the country's detriment.
Yeah. Very, very insightful. I mean, as you said, you saw it from the front lines. I do want to take a quick pause to remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. My guest is Miles Taylor, author of the new book, Blowback. Mr. Taylor also served in 2018 as former Department of Homeland Security Chief of Staff, and worked very closely with the Trump administration and saw things firsthand, the things that the average taxpayer, the average citizen never gets a chance to. And Miles, everything that's been happening since Donald Trump left office and going forward, and that now we're hearing all kinds of controversy regarding the Biden, both President Biden and his son, and nothing new. We've seen this time and time again, especially this culmination as we approach another election year. You know, one party wants to throw the dirt on the other, but I want to go to a fact that I don't think was so prominent 20, 30, 40 years ago, and that is the divisiveness, not of the political parties alone, but of the Americans themselves. I have never seen so many people, my neighbors, people in my community, people across the state of Massachusetts. I'm sure you see it on a broader spectrum. It's very hard to just get a handful of people to agree on anything anymore. So I'm wondering if the way we go about electing officials is starting to unwind, Democrats and Republicans, it's not like that anymore. That there are just so many fragmented groups and just so many disenfranchised people. Am I exaggerating this, or do you see the same fragmentation among Americans in general?
Well, no, it's definitely one of the most polarized periods in American history. In fact, that's actually quite easy to quantify. There's a group of researchers who put together something called the Political Stress Index, based off of a range of factors, you know, economics and the social situation and a whole range of different elements based on history to try to categorize each period in history and the level of political stress overall. And the researchers found that right now we are in a window where the political stress index is the highest it's been since the American Civil War. And that's really very alarming for all of the obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a really different period than the American Civil War. And at the top end, Al, you noted technology's influence on American politics. All of those elements of polarization that we saw back in the 1860s are now on steroids because the divisive rhetoric moves so quickly, and it's really a lot easier for people to group into their tribal affiliations. I mean, I'm going to give you a couple other data points to show how divided we are. You know, the trust in the two-party system has plummeted. But, you know, what is still very concerning is the people who remain within the two parties, statistics show, are getting more and more ideological and less interested in working with the other side. So for the first time in American history that I know of, a majority of Republicans and Democrats now say that the other side is not the opponent, but is the enemy.
Mm.
And that choice of language is very, very significant. And when the pollsters drill down into that and ask these folks what they mean, it's that they literally see the other side as an existential threat, as a threat to their way of life. Now, if that's your starting point, you're unlikely to extend a hand, reach across the aisle, and broker an agreement with someone else who you see as the enemy and not as an opponent who can be negotiated with. And that's had an enormous trickle-down effect into our politics, and a very frightening one. What's worrying to me as a national security professional is that we are seeing indicators of that polarization and that vitriolic rhetoric jumping the train tracks over into violence. And the surveys also show that. So we're seeing the largest spike in threats to public officials that we've seen in the modern era right now. And just to give you a sense, when Donald Trump came into office, there were maybe 1,000 or 2,000, threats against members of Congress, a year. And that has surged up to about 10,000. There's been a huge spike. But that's also happened at the state and local level. We've seen similar numbers. But then broader attitudes in the country towards political violence have gotten a great deal worse. I mean, depending on the survey you look at, NPR has done some, Ipsos has done some, the Pew Foundation has done several. 1 in 4 Americans, depending on the circumstances, have a somewhat favorable attitude towards political violence. 25% of the country. And there was a really shocking study out of the University of Chicago last year that showed that 10% of Americans believed Donald Trump should be forcibly reinstalled into the White House, as in, you know, guns and ammo, let's put him back in. That's 35 million American adults.
Yeah.
That's a really shocking figure. And again, when you look at it historically, these numbers are off the charts. So it's no longer a political concern. Our polarization is a public safety concern.
And thus the title of your book. I mean, after what, you know, after interviews that you had with Trump staff and administrators and just your own experience, you know, from someone who had a more of an insider's view, obviously you came up with the, you know, the term blowback, which is also the title of the book. But following along with what you just said is very interesting, because I don't think anybody can deny that that's exactly what's happening. So let me ask you, if a guy like Trump, or even anybody, Miles, whether it's a newcomer running for president, if they see this situation and they want to establish a platform, couldn't they just, you know, get on board and say, this is what happened with our current president. This is why there's divisiveness. It was this administration. I will tell you that I will unite the country. You know, all that type of rhetoric. So I'm just, what I'm asking is, I'm just wondering, because you know, because he can charge people up. And I'm talking about Trump when he gets on a platform, when he gets going. Might this be to his advantage?
The polarization?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, for sure. I mean, it's the nightmare fuel that I think is going to potentially propel him back into the White House, is that a really divided country plays to the advantage of someone who is very effective at whipping people into their tribal camps. And Trump has done that. I mean, he's very much leveraged the rhetoric of us versus them and the other side being an existential threat to keep his side together, to motivate them to go to the polls, and frankly, to form a pretty broad political coalition. I mean, people who are listening to this who loathe Donald Trump need to realize he has been remarkably effective at putting together a new conservative coalition in this country. And it's not just traditional Republicans. He's lost a number of those, mm-hmm. but he's picked up any number of different blue-collar Americans who actually didn't vote Republican before. And, right. you know this phenomenon if you've ever met someone who was a Bernie Sanders supporter, and so you thought, oh, okay, that's someone who's on the far political left. And then you find out they're also a Trump supporter, and you say, wait, what?
Yeah.
Who are these Bernie Trump supporters? Well, they are people who are so frustrated with the system, and they feel like they've been left behind, that they're actually open to either ideological extreme if it proposes to disrupt the system in such a way as it helps the everyday man. And you actually have quite a few of these Bernie Trump supporters, and it's again indicative of the fact that he's not just catering to one narrow ideological segment. He's put together a political coalition that's broader than people think, and that actually makes it more dangerous than most people on the left think it is. But Trump's going to run that same playbook this next go around, but he's actually been even more intense about it on the campaign trail, is signaling that the other side is going to completely destroy America and mobilizing people to feel like, again, almost like we're in a second civil war. And that sounds hyperbolic, and I talk about it in my book, but it's Trump's own people who are forecasting a civil war. I mean, just the other day, one of his closest advisors was just out on the airwaves warning that if the Democrats didn't make changes, that they would be heralding another national conflict on the scale of the last civil war. And that those words get tossed around even by Trump himself. In fact, I would note that more than a year before the insurrection on January 6th, Donald Trump was starting to talk publicly about his worry that there would be a coup in the United States, that a civil war might be coming. And around that time, I publicly warned that even if Trump lost the reelection in 2020, he would not go quietly or easily. And in fact, because of that rhetoric, I had a lot of concern that he would resist leaving office. And sure enough, that's what ended up happening. And at the time, again, a year before 2020, I said this could end tragically and violently. And it did. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't make me Nostradamus, Al.
Right.
It's just very obvious who this guy is. And so we should have the same clear-eyed perspective going into 2024, is that even if he is defeated in the presidential election, even if he is convicted by the courts through these various cases, he's not going to go quietly or easily. And it's something that we need to be wary of as citizens. And again, something that has, I think, potential public safety implications.
Yeah. And the thing that's fueling the fire in the few moments that we have, Miles, I've got to throw this out to you, is the fact that from coast to coast, various movements over the last 3 or 4 years, defund police departments across the country. And in some cases that has happened. We've seen crime rise to record highs in many cities. Look at San Francisco, New York City, Chicago. We're hearing this all the time. The haves and the have-nots. Once again, there's a wide disparity between people who are experiencing the American dream and those who are still scraping the bottom, if you will. And then there's the immigration issue and then COVID. So he's got a lot to work with. Things that can fuel the fire. But let me ask you, in the final few moments that we have here, are we at a tipping point? Seriously, are we at a tipping point as a country? As you said, and I agree with you, the two-party system is no longer what it used to be, for one. There's a lot of people who are disenfranchised. Liberals are joining conservative parties, and sometimes the opposite on, you know, conservatives going the other way. Are we at a tipping point, and could this be to this country's advantage, or could it spell disaster?
It could be both, Al. And let me take the scarier scenario first. In my book, Blowback, I spoke to a lot of different people who I would call democracy doctors, people who've really studied democratic stability throughout history and have a very clear-eyed view. Some of them are conservatives, some of them are liberals. Their politics don't really matter. But the general consensus among them was, you know, first, polarization, of course, as we've talked about, is the highest it's ever been. But two, that if we think the past 10 years have been bad, we ain't seen nothing yet, because the trend lines are getting worse and worse at the moment in terms of that polarization. And I mentioned it jumping the tracks to violence. And I'll give you an example of what someone said along those lines. A woman named Fiona Hill, who worked with me in the Trump administration, who was Trump's senior advisor for Russia.
Right.
Fiona spent most of her career focused on foreign countries where there's political instability. And one of the things she warns about is that we're entering a period that she calls soft secession, where red states are getting redder, blue states are getting bluer, that it's effectively like they are legally seceding from the union. They're creating totally different political environments and architectures. And in her view, that is sort of a leading indicator of a situation getting worse and leading to states actually calling for secession. Now, that sounds kind of crazy and hyperbolic until you, again, look at the polls. And right now, 65% of Southern Republicans say they would like their state to secede from the union. Mm. That's sort of a mind-blowing fact. So that's the scarier scenario, is that we could be trending that direction. But let me paint you the optimistic picture, which is, for the first time in American history, close to a majority of Americans say they are political independents, and they're frustrated with the two-party system and fed up with it. And in fact, the two parties have the lowest watermark they've ever had in terms of popular support. Both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party roughly have 25% of Americans that say they are part of either one. What that says to me is that the American people realize that the two-party system's gotten crusty, realizes it's continued to deliver them more and more partisan public officials, and that they want alternatives. And quite frankly, they want more choice and more competition in their democracy. And I think that's actually very exciting.
Yeah.
To have so many Americans say they are political independents creates a whole marketplace for new ideas, for new competition. And that's what democracy is supposed to be. We're supposed to be okay with the competition. And that means accepting that sometimes you lose and the other side wins, and that fair is fair.
Exactly.
And if we can return to that climate, I think it'll be very, very healthy for democracy. And there are the ingredients at the moment to inject things like third parties and new factions and new ways of engaging in democracy into our system that I think can breathe fresh life into it. And there, again, are a lot of indicators that that is possible, and a lot of interesting discussions happening across the country that maybe wouldn't have been possible.
Yeah.
20 or 30 years ago, when the majority of Americans were only members of one or two of the major parties.
Let's just hope so, for the sake of the country. In the meantime, people should really go out and buy Blowback, Miles' new book. Really gives some insightful information that I think the average citizen, the average voter, taxpayer, might not know, and might not get from the media in general. Miles, with the few moments that we have left, real quickly, if people want to reach out to you directly, how might they do that?
Yeah, for sure. Folks can find me on Twitter at Miles Taylor USA, and on Instagram and Threads at the same handle, at Miles Taylor USA.
Again, the book is Blowback. My guest has been the author, Miles Taylor. As I said, a great, insightful book. It really gives some opening the eye and letting people see what the political environment in this country is currently, and as Miles just talked about for the last half hour, there's a lot. There's a lot that's going to happen in the next in the next few months, the next year, going forward into the 2024 election. So let's start with blowback. Use that as a reference point, and then we'll go forward. Any questions about the broadcast? You can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in.